Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books and Music podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dan Moran. I'm thrilled to be here today with Will Birch, author of Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe, now out in paperback by Constable Books. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hi, Dan. Hi, nice to be there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a real thrill to speak to you. I'm a great admirer of your book. But before we dive into the book and Nick Lowe's career, can you tell us a little about you and your career?
Well, I started playing the drums, I guess, in the 1960s when I was a teenager. Big fan of The Who and the Rolling Stones, of course. In the mid-70s, I was in a group called the Curzle Flyers. We came out of the London pub rock scene, really. And we had a hit record in the UK with a song called Little Doshino. And then in 1978, I formed a group called The Records, with a friend, a co-songwriter called John Wicks. And we had a bit of success in the US with a song called Starry Eyes, which climbed the charts a little bit. We toured over there a fair bit. And then in the 90s, I did some record production. In the 80s, I should say, I did some record production. In the 90s, I'd never really written much before, only the odd angry letter to the Melody Maker or something like that. But I was, when Mojo magazine in the UK launched, they got in touch with me and asked me if I wanted to do some writing for Mojo. And of course I said, yes, I really enjoyed that. And that led me to books. My first book was called No Sleep Till Canvey Island, which was about the London pub rock scene of the 1970s. And since then I've done biographies of Ian Dury and of course Nick Lowe. So that's what I've done, my stuff.
Well, you said writing. I know you also co-wrote A1 on the Jukebox. With Dave Edmonds,
yes,
correct?
Yes, with Dave Edmonds. Actually, it was Nick who very kindly gave Dave my very crude home demo of the song with a fairly poor tune, and Dave put a better tune to it, and he recorded it on one of his albums in 1978. So that was a good year for, you know, songwriting. I got quite a few covers that year, but yeah, Dave did A1 on the Jukebox, which was thrilling for me, of course.
it still stands up. I listened to it yesterday. So let's move into Nick Lowe. So late in your book, you quote Jake Gralnick, Nick's co-manager, as saying this, quote, "The difference between Nick Lowe and other artists is that he never disappoints. He is Nick Lowe on stage and off stage. He is a total pleasure to be around, appreciative, and completely brilliant," quote. Comment?
Well, I guess Nick carries his personality on stage with himself, and then vice versa occurs when he comes off stage and he meets with fans or he does interviews and generally presents himself to his public. He can be very charming and witty, but he's always sincere. In private, he might occasionally drop his guard and speak his mind, but he is honest and he can tell it like it is when it's called for. And I'm sure that his manager, Jake Gralnick, has witnessed some of this side of Nick from time to time, but they've worked together for, well, nearly 30 years, which tells you something about their mutual respect. So I think when they hooked up in the 90s, you know, at that time, Nick was managed by Jake Riviera. The funny thing was that the two Jakes formed a management company called the Two Jakes, but now there's only one Jake with Nick, and that's Gralnick. So staying power on both sides, a lot of respect with Jake Gralnick. He's been very helpful to me over the years as well, so great guy.
Great guy.
And of course, he's the son of a very well-known music
biographer.
His dad, Peter Gralnick, has written some great books, so yeah.
Sure. So let's talk more about Nick's personality. He said, you know, off stage, he's famously self-deprecating, right? You quote him as saying, you have a lot of great, the book is filled with great quotations by him. And one of them is, "Whenever I hear one of my records on the radio now, I think there's been some kind of mistake." So Nick Lowe kind of has this image, this shtick, he calls it, of like cool nonchalance. And that's part of the persona, right? He says in your book, he says a quote, "I do take a lot of trouble to make the song sound like I've taken no trouble at all." And you quote journalist Peter Silverton at length on this. Silverton says, quote, "He really cares about what he does, but pretends he doesn't." Now, you got him to talk very much about his life and his songs and the writing process. And you say right at the beginning, and I love this line, you say right at the beginning, "The louder I listened, the more he talked." I love that. "The louder I listened, the more he talked." So how'd you get him to talk? What's he like?
Well, you know, I've known Nick for, I don't know, for 40, 50 years, something like that. I spent quite a bit of time with him in the 80s when I was working with Jake Riviera and looking after Carlene Carter. You know, I was tour manager for Carlene Carter for a couple of years. So I was always hanging out with them and got to know Nick. And he's always been very, very helpful to me. He's never declined an interview and so forth. But he does have his sort of what, you know, his shtick. And it's become ingrained in him, his wry humor, his sense of irony, his natural ability to rise above the mundane and see the funny side of almost any situation. And, of course, he does have what I would call a selection of stock jokes and one-liners that come out every now and then, a few of which occasionally escape the public domain. I always thought Rock Pile were very, very funny, especially their guitarist, the Scottish guitarist, Billy Bremner. He was very funny, Billy, and I think a lot of the humour came from him. He would begin every sentence with, For example, we're talking about a particular musician with a flamboyant name. If you think of somebody like Bo Diddley or Wayne Fontana, Billy might say, I wonder what his stage name is. You know, that sort of irony, you know, twisting it round. And another one, or if Billy had met a famous person on the road, he'd say, Prince Charles told me never to name drop, you know. I think that was actually one of Frankie Miller's Prince Charles name drop gag. But I guess you had to be there. But the ironic humour was all part of that. And it was a big thing in Rock Pile. Nick is naturally modest. He knows, of course, when he's written a really good song, but he always plays it down. I mean, anyone who's written "Lately I've Let Things Slide," you know, for example, must know it's a brilliant lyric. But he's able to make it come across as effortless, or his songs these days sound more effortless than the earlier ones did. You know, there's an economy of words and a tune that might sound slightly familiar, but different, you know. So he does feed off of 60 years of listening to pop music, you know, obviously, as you do. You know, you mentioned Pete Silverton. Pete Silverton was, or still is, a journalist. He wrote on an English weekly pop rock and roll publication called Sounds, I think he wrote for, and maybe he wrote for Musical Express as well. He knew Nick quite early on. They came from a similar neck of the woods, I think, in the days of Brinsley Schwartz. And but Pete, who's a bit younger than us, but he had great psychological insight into Nick's behaviour and the way Nick talked. And Pete Silverton is very perceptive. I mean, I was very pleased when he agreed to do an interview for me for the book, the Nick Lowe book. But he had a lot of insight. He could kind of read Nick, you know. He could tell when Nick was making it up a bit, and Pete was never afraid to mention like the truth, you know. So I was pleased to get Pete's perception on Nick. Very, very, very good. As far as my own experience goes with Nick, I think I've probably done a sort of 20 interviews with him over the years, whether it be like 10 minutes on the phone about his latest record for Mojo or something like that, to these long sessions we would have over lunch, which sort of became more intense as I was, you know, focusing on writing a book about Nick. At first, he kind of pretended he didn't know why I was doing all these interviews with him. And then one day he said, you mean you're writing a book? I said, sure, there should be a book about Nick Lowe out there. And of course, he's very modest. Who could possibly be interested in me? You know, that kind of thing. It was very, very funny. But these interviews, we'd meet face to face over lunch in the middle of London. And I would always have my recording device at the ready, which he pretended he couldn't. He sort of ignored it, you know, even when it was one of those big old things with a microphone like 20 or 30 years ago. Now it's a little tiny device, but he would always pretend, he would always completely ignore it, which I loved that. And, you know, we'd have the main course and they'd clear the table and bring the coffee. And then I would ask him a question. And I, once he got going, if it was a subject he was interested in talking about, he usually was, you know, I couldn't shut him up. And I just sat there and I listened and I listened. I mean, I do admit, I mean, occasionally I would butt in, you know, if I felt I wanted, what did you say there? What do you mean? You know, I had to butt in occasionally, but I usually let him run. And the longer I let him run, the funnier it got. And I recorded it and I've got dozens of hours of, well, I don't know, 30 hours or more of him on tape talking, which I've used much of. You know, I had to use in the book. He trusts me, I think, and he knows I'm a fan. I mean, I'm not afraid to say I'm a fan of your stuff. There's nothing wrong with that, I don't think. And he's great. You know, he's a terrific interview, as you know. Yeah.
It sounds like with the first question, you know, his off-screen, his off-stage persona and his on-stage persona, they're very, very, you know, much of a piece.
They are. And I think in recent years, he's even, I mean, if you go back to the 70s, he could be a little bit tricky. I mean, during that sort of post-punk rock period and when there was a lot of, let's say, indulgence going on, he could be a bit sharp with people. There's no doubt about that. But he's these days, you know, he's really he's naturally charming and funny, and he's I think he's pleased to be alive and pleased to be working, which is great, you know. So
yeah. So the first part of your book, which was all news to me when I read it, and I came to your book as already a super fan, but this was all news to me. The first part where you talk about his childhood and his father and his father's role in the RAF and all the exciting places where Nick grew up. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. Nick's father, Jeffrey Drain Lowe, it was in the Royal Air Force during the Second World War and through the 1950s, and he rose to quite high rank. He was awarded the CBE by the Queen, that's the Order of the British Empire, highly decorated for his bravery and leadership skills. When Nick was, about 6 or 7 years old, Drain got posted to Jordan during the Suez Crisis. You've probably heard of the Suez Crisis, and he was given the job of assisting with the security of King Hussein of Jordan, and this resulted in Nick with his dad going to King Hussein's, I would say, palace, his house, I guess. And Nick got a terrific lot of insight into the way that world works, and he also got insight. Nick also got insight into the lives of RAF Air Force officers, you know, on and off duty. I mean, the following year, I think we're talking now 57, when Nick was about eight years old, Drain was stationed in Cyprus, and Nick and the family all went out there to join him in the summer. And of course, these are the early years of rock and roll, you know, Elvis, etc. And as you probably know, the American air base, there were a lot of US air bases over there as well. And they used to have shops, you know, where the American servicemen could buy all sorts of American products, including gramophone records. So Nick's mum would go to the shop and buy, you know, an Elvis Presley LP or something. And consequently, Nick got to hear this stuff at a very, very early age. And then also they bought Nick, when he was showing signs of becoming an entertainer when he was very young, and they bought him a ukulele, which he learned a few chords on, and he would entertain his father's RAF colleagues and their wives at sort of social events they'd have in the basement of the place they lived in. So he, very early on, at 7, 8 years old, he was learning to entertain, and that's the sort of roots of it. And then you mentioned earlier about his genealogy going back further. I was absolutely intrigued to find out stuff that nobody knew. Nick didn't know anything. I mean, I can talk about that if you want and just add to the picture a little bit. I found out that on Nick's mum's side, her grandfather, in other words, Nick's great-grandfather, was an American Civil War veteran. Now, you know, you can't make this stuff up, right?
You don't see that coming as a Nick Lowe fan.
Don Thatcher, he fought in the American Civil War, what, 1860 or whenever that was, and he married an Austrian baroness called Alberta Caspar von der Trav. Nick didn't know any of this until I told him. And his great-grandmother's brother-in-law was a guy called Charles Adams Randall, American guy, who invented the jukebox. Now, come on, you know.
Come on, yeah, you can't make that up.
And I'm thinking, this is crazy. And then I found out that Nick's maternal grandfather was a guy called Louis Victor, was a child actor. And his mum sent him out on the boards and billed him as the Dude Venile, which is a play on juvenile, and the Dude Venile. And I'm thinking of Nick's songs, and I'm thinking half a boy and half a man. Come on, you know. And then I'm thinking about the Civil War guy, who was a bit of a tricky guy. I mean, he had a lot of sort of scams going on and stuff. I'm thinking, you know, all men are liars. This guy did tell a lot of fibs, you know. And then I'm thinking Rose of England, the Civil War, from High on the Hill came the clarion call. Nick has subconsciously written these songs, which directly reflect 19th century, his family history, of which he was ignorant. So that was thrilling. But the funny thing is, actually, when my book came out, I generally get quite good reviews, and on social media, people are pretty kind. But there was one fairly sniffy comment about all this history, and it was a bit of a put down. But personally, I find it interesting. But my editor moved it to the back of the book because he wanted to get to the rock and roll.
Right. So it's an appendix now called All Men Are Liars.
But interestingly, nobody has hardly mentioned it, and it's almost a sit. So I don't know if people don't get to the back of the book, but it's surely a fantastic, fascinating story. I think.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I certainly got to the back because all the stuff when he's a kid is great. Like you have that, you know, and then you go back further than when he's a kid. You have that great. I love the story of him playing the ukulele you mentioned, and his father and his father's friends, and his father would give him a look and say, "Okay, that's enough."
Yeah, exactly.
And that's how Nick Lowe learned, you know, how do you read a room and things like that. But the great thing about your appendix is that it goes even further back than that, which made me laugh when I was reading it. I'm like, this is such a great find.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Nick does. He knows when to start. I mean, his live shows now, his solo shows, if it's just him on his own, not without Lost Straitjackets, he'll do an hour and 17 minutes, you know, including on – he's always – you know, he keeps it very concise. And the time flies by, but you think, well, that's fair. You know, he's done a good show, but he kind of knows – he doesn't overstay his welcome on stage, and I really respect that. I think it's great.
Yeah, me too. And I've seen him live several times, as I'm sure you know, as you have as well. But let's get back to Nick. So in 1962, he's at school. He meets Brinsley Schwartz. He's 13 or 14. About 6 years later, he gets this call from Brinsley. Nick joins the band, named after Brinsley Schwartz, and your book had me hyping on their music for several weeks. And you tell this great story. I love this story about this event from 1970 called The Hype. So tell our listeners, what was The Hype?
Well, The Hype actually is the chapter title in the Nick biography. And it's a well-known word for exaggerating something and making it and promoting something as better than it really is. You know, that's what a hype is, as we all know. But there was another reason why the chapter was called The Hype, which I might get to in a moment. But I researched The Hype with dozens of people who were around at the time. I mean, this is 1970. And I was fortunate enough to get interviews with all the members of Brinsley Schwartz, I think, their manager, Dave Robinson, and all the record company guy, Andrew Lauder, who were involved in what, let's call it the hype for convenience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was doing, yeah.
So I wrote about it in detail in No Sleep Till Canvey Island, and what there is in the Nick Lowe biography is a very truncated version, because anybody who really wants to know more can hopefully find No Sleep Till Canvey Island. But I obviously had to tell the story in my Nick book. And what happened was I've got to now switch my brain into fact and fiction mode, because you want to know what the facts were rather than the theory. But the facts were that Brinsley Schwartz, they'd been on the sort of club circuit in London, playing places like the Marquee. And as you probably know, they were originally called Kippington Lodge. And in 1969. That name was sounding a bit dated, I guess, and somebody said, we need a new name. And to Brinsley's horror, the other guys in the group said, we're going to go out as Brinsley Schwartz. And Brinsley said, well, nobody asked me. Anyway, they were managed by Dave Robinson. Dave Robinson, who was a co-founder of Stiff Records some years later, Dave Robinson had worked in America as tour manager for Jimi Hendrix. And he also managed one or two other groups, and he discovered, if you like, Brinsley Schwartz, and along with a couple of other people, managed them. And they wanted to get Brinsley Schwartz a record deal, the record companies were very slow to respond, as is usually the case. So they decided between themselves, they called these Dave and these people called themselves Fame Pushers. And they formed a limited company called Fame Pushers Limited. They had lunch one day, and they decided the way to launch Brinsley Schwartz would be with a big show. And they said, well, where can we put them on? And the PR guy said, well, there's a nice club in London, you know, and Dave said, no, too small. And then somebody said, what about the Royal Albert Hall, you know, 6,000-seat venue in the middle of London? No, it's got to be bigger. And they talked it up over lunch till somebody said, why don't we put them on in America? In New York. Now, from Dave's days with Jimi Hendrix, he had quite a lot of contacts in America, including the Bill Graham, who was the promoter at the Fillmore Auditoriums in San Francisco and indeed in Manhattan. And Dave pestered Bill for a gig, and initially, of course, Bill said no. And then one day Bill says yes. He said, well, I can put you on in April, it's 1970. You can open for Quicksilver Messenger Service, who were the headline act, and in the middle of the bill, Van Morrison. Well, of course, Dave was thrilled, because Dave Robinson knew Van Morrison when they were kids in Ireland. Morrison was in Dublin. Dave was in Dublin. Morrison was up in Belfast, but they met quite a few times, and I think Dave took photos of Van early on, because Dave did a bit of photography. Anyway, so thrilled to get the gig. So what are they going to do? They're going to put the group on in New York. Now, the record company say, well, if the New York show happens, you've got a record deal. United Artists Records, fantastic. So the PR guy says, well, what we'll do, we'll hire a plane and we'll fly over 100 journalists. So luckily, Dave Robinson had a mate at Aer Lingus, the airline, and he persuaded Aer Lingus to give them a jet for a return flight to New York for a mere £7,000, is about $10,000. It's nothing, really, for a whole aeroplane there and back. And they invited the press, and they got lots of well-known media personalities and journalists. Anyway, the show is on, the journalists are going. And 2 weeks before the event, everything, and I mean everything, goes wrong. You couldn't make up what happened. The band get busted for drugs, for example. They get turned down for work permits to play in America. They get refused American visas as a result. So what do they do? So Dave and his girlfriend, Dot, they say, well, they look at a map and they go, well, New York, well, that's quite near Toronto, which is in Canada, which is part of the British Empire. Why don't they fly to Toronto and then somehow, I don't know, drive, you know, a few hundred miles down to New York. They fly to Toronto. While they're in Toronto, there's a countrywide strike by the landing. What are those people called? The air traffic controllers go on strike. All the planes are grounded. There are no planes into the USA from anywhere, including Toronto. come on. Dave hires a 6-seater micro plane with a Japanese pilot, and they fly on this little plane to New York on the day of the show. They get airsick. I could go on. I mean, the plane containing the journalists loses brake fluid over the Irish Sea and has to make an emergency landing in Ireland. And they have to wait for a replacement. This is on the day of the show. It goes on and on and on. And, of course, the event was a complete failure. And the group come back with their tail between their legs. And the rest is history, I guess. But I'm very passionate about this because I think I can over the years, I've been approached by one or two film people. And, in fact, my book has been optioned twice as the basis for a dramatic reconstruction movie of the story. The last firm who had it 3 years ago, they pulled it. They couldn't get the funding. But the dream is still out there to make a movie of this. And it could be.
It would be. It's very cinematic. It's very cinematic when you read it because you just keep thinking. It's a fantastic story. And as a first time. Yeah. And as a first time reader, as somebody who didn't know this story, when I was going through the book the first time, I could tell in the back of my mind, I'm like, they're going to do the show and they're going to sound horrible. And it's going to like that. The climax has to be that the show itself has to be a disaster. And as you tell it was because you have the great scene of all them. Yeah. That they're all watching Van Morrison and they're like, oh, this is what we're supposed to sound like.
Exactly. And he's just coming off of Moondance. I mean, can you imagine how great? I mean, I saw Van Morrison around that time. Sensational show. And they learned quite a lot from that experience, I think.
Yeah, I bet they did. So, all right, well, fast forward now. 1972, you mentioned him before, but 1972, Nick meets Dave Edmunds. And he and Dave Edmunds form Rockpile with, you know, Nick and Billy Bremer and Terry Williams. One thing your book does really well, it gives a sense of how big Rockpile was. So how big was Rockpile? What was Rockpile like when it burst on the scene?
Well, Rockpile weren't as big as they should have been. I mean, they were the most exciting four-piece, I want to say rock and roll. They're not really a rock band. I mean, their music's based on rock and roll, 12-bar blues. It's based on the music of Chuck Berry, etc. But for that type, I mean, I guess the nearest thing would be like Creedence Clearwater Revival kind of had that vibe. And over here we had Rockpile. I think Rockpile could have been massive, really, really much more successful. But sadly, they bailed. They bailed out on the brink of stardom. I mean, their debut album, which actually followed several solo albums by Dave Edmunds and Nick Lowe, as we know, which were essentially Rockpile records, but they went out as Dave or Nick. The same four people, you know, with Terry and Billy, made the records, and they made the Rockpile LP. And when it came out in late 1980. It was actually scaling the American hit parade. And when things started to go a bit awry within the Rockpile camp, they were getting fantastic press. I mean, they'd done this tour a year before. They'd done this tour opening for Blondie across the USA. That got them a very big following. And from 77, 8, 9, 80, for 3.5 years running, they toured America a lot and they built a following. They were ready to ignite, in my opinion. They were making a good living, you know, and Billy Bremner's telling his jokes and Terry Williams is the hardest driving drummer in the history of rock and roll. I mean, they were just a fantastic group. But unfortunately, there was some business problems behind the scene. And there was a sort of triumvirate, if you like, of Dave Edmunds, Nick Lowe and Jake Riviera. And Jake Riviera was the manager of Elvis Costello, but he was also the manager of Rockpile. And it's a very complex story, and I'm not really at liberty to speculate on the details. But let's just say Dave Edmonds didn't kind of agree with some of Jake's business plans and said so. That caused a rift between Dave and Jake Riviera. But also at that time, let's not forget, Nick Lowe was obliged to make his next solo album for Columbia. He'd done the first one, which had a different title in America to what it had in England, as you know. That had caused a bit of interest. And he's making his second LP. And, you know, there's pressure on him to finish the recording and get the record out. So there were a lot of little internal conflicts. Anyway, basically, Dave Edmonds and Jake fell out. And Edmonds left Rock, well, Rockpile just dissolved suddenly, you know, in, I think, February 1981. In fact, I remember personally that day I went to the offices of what was called Riviera Global for a beer with a few people, including Nick. And as we walked up the road to the pub, Nick said, "Oh, Rockpile broke up today." It was that they'd had a group meeting literally that day, and I remember him telling me about it. I couldn't believe it, you know. But that was that. It was disappointing because I think they could have got onto great, great stuff, you know. But that's all I can really tell you about Rockpile. They were just great, though. They were a great group.
Yeah, you make a point that that everybody wanted to see them live, and that the record didn't do them justice.
Yeah, well, I was, you know, slightly disappointed with the Rockpile LP. I think on the solo albums, Nick had gone a long way to do some great songs. Dave did some good covers and co-writes, dare I say. I think the Rockpile album was a bit, you know, it was kind of okay, but there were too many, in my opinion, too many sort of R&B covers. It could have been a bit better. There's, by the way, there's a very good book recently published about Rockpile in Sweden called Crawling from the Wreckage, put together by a guy called Rickard Bengtsson. And I think he only sells it online, and he's doing a second volume of it, which is being put together now. So Rockpile fans, if they can find it, the Crawling from the Wreckage book will tell you a lot about, great pictures in there as well. So,
oh, that's great. I just wrote that down. Let's jump ahead a little bit, because you just mentioned Elvis Costello, and I have to jump ahead and make sure we get some time with him. You talk about these early records, like his solo records and Rockpile. That's kind of like the first act of his career. And I love the phrase that you quote Nick of saying that he used this thing called stunt rhyming. And that reminded me of Elvis Costello. You just mentioned Elvis Costello. You know, they've toured together. They have some dates together in California at the end of this month. Can you talk about their relationship and how they've influenced each other personally or musically?
Yeah, I mean, they're, as you know, they've been touring the States recently together with Nick opening the show with Los Straitjackets. Elvis Costello was a Brinsley Schwartz fan when he was very young, and he obviously recognised in Nick, you know, some great songwriting, and I was inspired by Nick and, of course, other songwriters, but the what's key here is the London pub rock scene of the early 1970s, because Elvis had a group who tried to kind of, you know, they're called Flip City, who played on the scene, but they didn't quite make it. But that's when he'd bump into Nick at the various shows and indeed Jake Riviera, and Elvis's enthusiasm for Nick's songwriting and trying to get his own career off the ground sort of indirectly led to what became Stiff Records in 1976, which was started by the aforementioned Dave Robinson and Jake Riviera. And, of course, Nick and Elvis were on Stiff Records. I think that they've got a terrific mutual – Nick and Elvis have got a terrific mutual respect, and of course Nick became Elvis's producer. Nick produced the first five Elvis albums, the ones that were really the foundation of his career, really, and then two or three really albums since then. So I just think it's a mutual respect. But you talk about the stunt rhyming. I mean, there was a lot Well, look at some of Elvis Costello's lyrics. I mean, they're very clever, aren't they? And I love the guy. Sometimes a little bit overworked, maybe. And I think Nick recognised that in his own songs there was a sort of an overworking, if you go back to the 70s and the 80s particularly. And I think one day he woke up and decided, no, this has kind of got to stop. You know, I've got to really pare it back. And consequently, his songs are sort of more mature. But I'd forgotten about that stunt rhyming phrase. Nick's lyrics today are a bit more subtle and natural, rather than that sort of in one ear and out the other that sort of occurred 30-odd years ago, 40 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, I mentioned Elvis because everybody who likes Nick Lowe also likes Elvis Costello, and vice versa. You know, they're absolutely. I mean, my whole youth was spent, you know, one after the other. It was Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello. You mentioned that, you know, as I knew that Nick Lowe produced Elvis's first five albums. He produced later ones, like I know he produced Blood and Chocolate and some other ones after that. And you talk about Nick as a producer in the book a lot. So for those listening though, who might be a bit unsure, can you talk about, you know, what does the producer of a record do? You know, why is that so important? And why do people want Nick to produce their records other than his, you know, the power of his name?
Well, I think record producers come in many shapes and forms, you know, from a sort of a trained recording engineer who knows how to work the desk in the studio, might become a producer when they start adding some inspired stylistic suggestions, and they become so. Some record producers have started off as recording engineers, and then at the other end of the scale, there are chancers like myself. I've got my name on quite a few records from the 1980s. When I wasn't a record producer, but you know, you get off with the gig, and do you turn it down? You're not really gonna. You know, I produced, I don't know, The Long Riders, Dr. Feelgood, Any Trouble. I did a record with the Hollies. You know, I did a lot of stuff in that period, and I wasn't particularly good. But so I'm at the other end, and in the middle of this, there's the really inspired producers. Now, Nick's skill. I mean, Nick's skill is really founded on his personality and his instinctive knowledge about how a record should. I mean, Nick wouldn't pretend to know. There's only one control on the desk Nick knows how to work, and that's the volume control. Oh, on the button when you push down to talk to the studio. We'll do that one again, please. You know, he wouldn't pretend to be technical. He's not. But what he's got a fantastic way of getting the best out of musicians. So when it comes to groups like the Pretenders, for example, he did a record with the Pretenders, or Dr. Feelgoods, you know, he understands that because Nick's got the experience, he understands the makeup and psychology behind a rock quartet. And they're all the same. I mean, every four-piece rock and roll band is made up of four stereotypes. I'll go off on a tangent. I won't do that. But Nick knows this, and he knows how to get the best out of the musician. So, you know, he will say if the bass player is in the corner and he's, you know, having a bad day, he'll take the bass player to one side and encourage him out of earshot of the other three. It's little things like that, and that's what he's very good at. And that's why he has been in demand as a producer. But he hasn't done too much record production lately, so I don't know if I think he gets offered it, but I think he's sort of moved on from it, really.
In your book, it makes the impression that like his whole vibe makes people, you know, perform better. Like they say, athletes, you know, but if you're a mediocre football team, you'll play better with a top notch football team. And that he kind of brings this thing to the studio, and exactly what you said, it's not technical. He's not there moving all the dials, but he knows what the song should sound like, the platonic version of the song, right? And then he kind of gets it out of the musicians.
Yeah, he does. He instinctively knows that he could do when it can do with a tambourine or a male voiced choir, you know, he knows that. And he's also very funny. So sometimes some of his, let's say, studio jokes kind of go over the head of people. Say, what does he mean by that? You know, the old standbys. But he creates a good vibe in the studio, and everybody has a good time, because studio work can be, you know, you're in there for maybe 11, 12 hours relentlessly and people are falling asleep or whatever they're doing, he keeps the vibe going. So, yeah, that's his skill, really. It's a personality thing, I think. And of course, he has a terrific knowledge of popular music and the reference points. And could we make that a bit more like the Shirelles or whatever it is, you know?
Right, yeah. If you have a song, if you have a demo and Nick Lowe says, I have some ideas, you're going to listen to what those ideas are.
Yeah, exactly. He's a good producer.
So we mentioned Elvis Costello, and I want to mention another friend of Nick's, which is John Hiatt. So I recently had the chance to interview Michael Elliott about his new biography of John Hiatt. And we know that in 91, Hiatt and Nick and Ry Cooder and Jim Keltner formed this super group, Little Village. I remember when the Little Village record came out, I was so excited. So this is the third big group, you know, Nick Lowe's been a part of. And I want to ask you the same question I asked Michael Elliott, you know, what happened with Little Village and what does the Little Village story from start to finish suggest about the music business and your experience?
Well, I'm probably going to be quite controversial. I mean, I'm a huge fan, obviously, of Ry Cooder, John Hiatt, Nick, obviously, and Jim Keltner, great drummer, the very best, in my humble opinion. But I think the problem was that Little Village were too much of a musical democracy. I mean, you've only got to look at the record, haven't you? Produced by Little Village. Well, it says it all, in my opinion. I mean, they could have done with a tough producer, an external producer, not four producers or two and a half or whatever. They could have done with a third party or a second party in the room, in my opinion. And I personally think that that record was a little bit self-indulgent. I mean, I went to see them live when they played in London, obviously. Very, very good show. They all looked a little bit terrified. Nick particularly looked really frightened, and was in quite a big venue. But anyway, if you get to hear some of their live performances, you know, you can find them on the internet. Some of the gigs they did after they'd done the album and they're on the road for 7 or 8 months, they kind of matured. In other words, they really perhaps should have made the record after they'd done the tour. Let someone else produce it. And you know, I just think it's a bit too busy as a production. And I don't know what it did chart-wise or sales-wise, but I think it was probably a bit of a disappointment for the record company. But I think that the record company, I think they were sort of in awe of these people. I mean, Ry Cooder had been associated with that label already for, 15 years or something. I mean, Ry Cooder, he's just brilliant. I mean, John Hiatt, great songwriter. You know, they were fantastic. I think they had too much freedom. And I think the record, for me, was a disappointment.
And
only an opinion.
Yeah, no, that's what Elliott says too, is that when you're given that they had all the money they wanted, they had all the studio time they wanted, they had all the toys they wanted, but they had no more constraints. And those constraints, a lot of times, can help in any art, can help produce great stuff.
Yeah, they did spend a lot of hours on it as well. That's the other thing. I think that it was a bit indulgent, you know? Anyway.
Right, yeah. All right, so let's move ahead. Act two. Yeah. Let's go to act two. So we get these, act two of Nick's career, we get these three, I think, unbelievable albums that people call the Brentford Trilogy. We get The Impossible Bird in 94, Dig My Mood in 98, and The Convincer in 2001. Incredibly strong albums. So talk to us about this second phase of Nick's career. You know, what's like the first act? What's different? What is act two of Nick Lowe's career?
Well, if that's act two, he which is what it's probably known as, you know, he'd come of age. He'd been through the gimmicky 1980s. I mean, if you listen to Nick's albums of the four albums, I think, of in the 1980s, which I love, by the way, and there's some fabulous songs on. Some of them are a little bit kind of overworked in the joke department. And there are some gimmicky tracks. They're patchy, but obviously there was some great stuff on there. But he realised this. I think when he got to that sort of fourth album in 89, I think he wanted to take some time off, which he did. I mean, he had personal things going on in his life as well. He got himself a little pad in London and he sort of disappeared for a couple of years. And he was just rethinking the whole thing. And I think he thought, well, if I'm going to come back, And I think he still had a record deal. I mean, it wasn't like he couldn't record, but I think he thought it was time for change. And he went into a period of reflection. He started demoing his songs on his own. You know, he'd hire a pub, for example, a private room in a pub, and go in there with his guitar, set a little PA system up so he could get a bit of a sound, bit of atmosphere, and just stand in there for 3 or 4 hours singing to himself. That funny line about the cleaning ladies would come around and say, who's this poor guy who has to come perform for himself in the pub at lunchtime? You know, can't he play for the public? But this was Nick, you know, getting to rethink it. Fortunately also, if you like, Bobby Owen, the drummer, came back from America. Bobby had been out working in the States. Bobby, who'd been in Nick's band in the early 80s, came back, and they form very much of a bond. And there are two or three other characters, and between them, they formed a little bond. And the rule really was, you know, don't overthink it, don't overplay it, keep it stripped down, and, you know, keep literally at like a lower profile. I don't think he wanted to make the mistakes of the previous decade. He needed a slower pace, a greater depth of expression in his work, if that doesn't sound sort of pretentious. And he took everything back to basics. And he only elaborated when absolutely necessary, not for the sake of elaboration. I mean, sometimes you'll produce a record and think, oh, we've got to have the bells and whistles on that. It's got to sound. No, Nick stripped it back, and he only put the little bits in when they were really needed. So that was really what you call it, Act Two, I guess, which is still going on, isn't it? Act Two has actually become Act Two and a half now, although he hasn't done too much recording in the recent years. About time he did a bit more, I think. But I love some of his newer songs as well.
Oh, they're great. They're great. So we could talk about those. I mean, you talk about stripping down. That's a great way to describe him, right? You reviewed Dig My Mood in 1998, and you said that the vocal set really high. You said it's 70% of the picture, so you can crank it up without the drums annoying the neighbors. So his, which is so true, and that's so, I think, evocative of what Act Two or Act Two and a Half is about. So in 2020, his latest, you know, EP comes out, Lay It On Me, which is incredible. He's 71. I listen to that all the time. I think it's great. And you quote him as saying, I love this line about him performing now. He says, when you're performing, you don't feel like you're any age at all. So we've talked a lot about, you know, the young Nick and the older. Like, how do you think his age has made him, even more cool, or cooler in a different way than he was when he was like the Jesus of cool when he was younger? Like, how much has age, do you think, fed into, you know, his new batch of songs and the way he sings now?
Well, I think when he goes on stage, not a character, because he's very sincere, but he's on another planet when he's on stage. You know, he's not thinking about, that's why I think what he means by age is nothing when he's singing. It could be any age. But pop music and rock and roll has been the domain of the young, hasn't it, for years, teenagers really. And don't forget, you know, if you only got to go back 30 or 40 years, musicians were ribbed for being old, you know, 30, you get out of here. You know, I think that Mojo magazine, English music magazine, helped to change the mindset. I think if you look at some of the early issues, I'm not plugging Mojo, by the way, but if you look at some of their early issues from the mid-90s, there's no mention of an artist's age in any of the reviews. I think I'm right in saying this. Record reviews, interviews, stories about bands, they played down age completely. Now, I don't know if that was a conscious thing on their part, but you'd be hard-pressed to find, you know, Chuck Berry, 78, they didn't print it. They used Chuck Berry, you know, and the young people were the young people. It was a sort of mini revolution. And suddenly it was cool to be 40 or 50 or 60, providing that you weren't attempting to remain a teenager like we all did, you know, when we were like 35. I can remember, like, in the records, you know, I was like 31 or something at the time. I convinced myself I was 19. You know, that was my attitude when I got on the tour bus, you know. That's all gone now. And it's no longer about wanting to remain teenager, and it's no longer about appearance as well. Elvis Costello made a very good crack, you know, about Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, which I think is in my book. And we all love Steven Tyler, of course, but Elvis Costello said, talking about Tyler's image, which he still carries today, isn't that an awful lot of work every morning, you know? and Nick Lowe personifies the pop musician who grew old gracefully. In fact, I think you'd go as far as to say Nick was kind of the first. Who else has there been? I mean, Leonard Cohen always looked mature, and I guess you can say Tom Waits grew old gracefully. But Nick was one of the first to say, hey, you know, I'm not going to try and dress like an 18-year-old anymore. I'm 60, and I'm going to, you know, but he looks pretty cool. He carries it off. But suddenly, you know, old is good. You know, old is value. If you've got that, provided you can still get up and strum, it's great, isn't it? So we like old people.
I just love your comparison. That never occurred to me until right this moment, the comparison with Leonard Cohen, because, you know, at the end of his career, when you're watching Leonard Cohen, you could be 18 and think, man, like, there's a cool guy, and who had, you know, talk about somebody who embraced it over his career, what Leonard Cohen was like at the beginning and at the end when he started wearing his fedoras and going, you know, and how his voice changed and his songs, you know, reflected the new change in his voice. That's a great comparison.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen sort of looked mature. There are very few, though. There are loads of them now. I mean, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's loads of groups who are sort of, you know, emphasizing their age. But if you go back only 15 years or so, there weren't many acts out there who were prepared to not dress like a teenager anymore.
Yeah, because when you're a kid, it makes sense. Like when he was younger, he wants to write these like cutting songs, like Mary Provost or So It Goes. And that's, you know, he didn't have songs like the ones on The Convincer in him yet, or so to speak. So that's a great way to think about it. So let's talk about his, you know, his fan base for a moment. You know, he's one of these, Nick Lowe is one of these figures that not everyone knows about, but those who know about him really, really like him. I mean, Jerry Garcia once said about the Grateful Dead, he said, deadheads are like people who like licorice. Not everyone likes licorice, but the people who do really, really like it. And I want to get a reaction to you from something in your book. I'm going to just read you a quotation from your book, and I wanted to get your reaction to this because I thought it was spot on. Quote, "His more recent music is virtually unknown beyond a loyal band of followers, despite its undeniable crossover appeal. His fans are mystified, yet one senses an air of protectiveness surrounding their favorite music maker. Do they really want him to be discovered by the masses? Is he the secret his fans would rather not share?"
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a sort of a bit of, there's always been a sort of a slightly sort of snob value, hasn't there, in any music you like. I mean, if you like classical music, everybody's heard of Beethoven, but a lot of classical fans will reference some really obscure Austrian guy that you've never heard of. And Nick's a bit like the obscure Austrian. He's not the Beethoven. He's not the Rolling Stone or the, you know, he's. But his music is very mainstream, actually, and would, I believe, have a very broad appeal if it reached a wider audience. But I don't know how it's done anymore. I mean, there's thousands of people who would enjoy his work if only they discovered it. I mean, I can remember sometimes, you know, I'd be in the car with a friend or something who wasn't a music person, and I'd have a CD on or something, and I'd play a track by lots of people, but say Nick Lowe, and people say, "Oh, this is good. What's this?" And you go, "You don't know what this is. This is Nick Lowe. It's or Elvis Costello. It's kind of like a well kept secret." And you know, I think that I don't know that if he, you see, really, I won't say Nick is to blame, but he definitely went through a period when he didn't want to promote himself. You know, he would be offered a TV, like a chat show or something like that, because he's a personality and he's a funny guy, and he did turn it down. He definitely didn't promote himself in, let's say, the early 90s. If you go back to post those 80s records, he kept it low-key. I guess there's a price you pay for that. I think he enjoys his position in where he is. You know, he makes a good living from music, I think, you know, and he's got his fan base, and it's serious. The people who like Nick love Nick, but I think he could have a broader appeal. But I think there's a sort of, I think a lot of fans like to keep him to themselves. You know, sometimes when an act's got a cult following and they break through, and there have been examples of this, some of the early people drop away, but by then it doesn't matter because they're selling millions of records. But I think, yeah.
Well, your book makes the great point of how when the soundtrack to the film The Bodyguard came out, all of a sudden he got all this money from royalties for a cover of Peace, Love, and Understanding. And it was almost like he had it made, because now I can do what I want and I don't have to, you know, I have money coming in, everything's going to be fine, and now I can do the Nick Lowe I want to do.
Well, yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because a moment ago when we were talking about that Act Two, you know, really, I think that surely what we're talking about here was happened around that time, didn't it? And that may have given him the wherewithal to take his foot off the gas. That may have funded, I won't say indulgent, but it funded his reevaluation of his work and gave him, he could take 2 years off, because I believe he suddenly got a chunk of change in the bank, you know. But what a fantastic thing to happen. I mean, wouldn't it be terrible if he didn't have at least one song which is, you know, done very well and made him some money, because he's written 200 really good songs.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those songs. So you know, we'll combine a question about your title to your own personal taste in Nick Lowe here. So, you know, the title of your book strikes me as inevitable. You're writing a biography of Nick Lowe. It's got to be Cruel to Be Kind. You mentioned playing songs for people in the car and they don't know it's Nick Lowe. And then you might say, you know, the guy that sings Cruel to Be Kind. Oh, yeah. Like people know, everyone knows Cruel to Be Kind, right? And he says, you know, originally he didn't want to record it. He did. It's kind of become his calling card. He says that, you know, the song has been very good to me. So I assume that was an easy choice for your title. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe you'll tell me. Then you could talk about your favorite songs as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's corny in a way. It's sort of obvious, but it had to be that, because it's the recognition factor. So when people who don't know who Nick Lowe is and they're in the bookshop and they see it on, they go and they see Cruel to Be Kind, maybe they go, oh, I know that song. I mean, I was on vacation a couple of years ago in California, and I was in a shop. It was a drugstore. I was picking up some pills or something, and they had the music, you know, the music going on in the background, and Cruel to Be Kind, Nick Lowe's Cruel to Be Kind started playing, and then went up to the till to pay for the whatever, toothpaste or whatever. The guy said, "Who's this?" The guy on the shop worker. "I know this song. Who's this?" And I couldn't believe it. I said, "This is in that town. What's the town where the famous actor was the mayor? The rawhide guy. Clint Eastwood was the mayor."
Clint Eastwood, Carmel, California. Carmel,
I was in
California.
Carmel, that's right. And he said, "Who is this?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I can tell you that is an English singer by the name of Nick Lowe." And he went, "Oh, no, don't know him." But he knew the song. So you go in the bookshop, Cruel to Be Kind, clearly has to be the title. But also behind the title is, I felt it gave me a sort of license to have a little dig now and again and tell the truth. If I think, you know, he's been a bit of a silly boy, I can say I can be cruel to be kind to the guy, you know. So it had to be the title.
Yeah. It had to be, yeah. And let's. This is a silly question, but I just want to end with this because the answers change for day by day. But what are some of your favorite Nick Lowe songs? I mean, he's written over 200 of them. You know, your list might change this afternoon. But what are some of the ones that you go back to that every time you hear them, maybe they knock you out?
Well, funnily enough, I was asked this very similar question about 2 months ago when I did an interview, and I made like a little top 10, and I found it. I'd written it down, and I look at it now, and although it does obviously change from day to day, it's still pretty much the same 10 songs. And songs I love, Don't Lose Your Grip on Love, which he recorded with Brinsley Schwartz. I mean, somebody's got to cover that one day. I mean, it's just, I mean, maybe someone has covered it, but somebody's got to, like, I'd love to see an established soul artist do it because it's such a good song. I love that. Moving through solo career, I love Mary Provost. I mean, it's a little bit gimmicky, but it's very, very funny. And Mary Prevost, you know, the tragic actor. In fact, going off on a complete tangent, I was walking through a park here where I live in Essex, England, about 6 months ago. And you know the plaques they put on the benches where in honour of people who have died. And I was walking along and I looked to the right, and there is a plaque in memory of Mary Provost with a birth date, died 1975, I think. From her family or whatever. I took a photo of it. I thought, well, what's the chances? Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but that's another story. But I love Mary Provost. I love on the Rock Pile album, my favourite track on there is Now and Always, which sounds kind of like a Buddy Holly song, I guess. You know, it's a simple song, beautiful melody. Number four would be The Rose of England. Up High on a Hill came the clarion call. Yeah, great, great song.
Damned if you don't, and damned if you do. That's
yeah, damned if you do. Yeah, great, great song. A bit gimmicky, but I really like All Men Are Liars because it's, again, so funny. And right. The Rick Astley
joke is so funny. Every time I hear that, I laugh. I mean, it's just that he got him in there. I just, every time I hear that, I laugh.
I always wonder if Rick Astley's still around here. He has the odd hit record in England, and he tours. He must have heard the song. He must have heard, somebody must have, his manager must have told him about it. But that's a funny line. He had a great big hit. It was Ghastly. And that was, I love The Beast in Me because it's so raw and stripped back. And, of course, Johnny Cash's version is bags of atmosphere, but Nick does his own song very well. Love that. I also, getting slightly into the gimmicky, I Trained Her to Love Me. I mean, I can remember the first time I heard that song. Before it came out on a record, I went to see him do a solo show in London in a big theatre. Just him and I think Geraint Watkins might have been with him on piano. And he did his songs, you know, cruelly. Then he suddenly did I Trained Her to Love Me. And I'm sitting in a seated auditorium and he's singing these lines. And there are you could physically feel women with their husbands or their boyfriend. People were sort of cringing at this bluntness of this song. And I'm thinking, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. So that's one of my favorites.
Because it's if I can interrupt for a second, I love that song so much because it's so un-Nick Lowe-like. You know, he's not he's this cool gentleman, but in that one, he's a player, which the persona is so unlike what you want from Nick Lowe or expect from Nick Lowe. That's why it's so funny.
Yes, so I could go ahead and break her heart. You know, it's so callous, isn't it? Nick always says, you know, that you don't have to believe the things he sings in his song. It's only a song. It's all fiction. I kind of think under the surface, I don't know, there's a bit of personal stuff in there. What are we on to? Three more. Lately, I've Let Things Slide. That is so good, isn't it? With a growing sense of dread and hammer in my head, fully clothed on the bed. Just that untouched takeaway I brought home the other day has got quite a lot to say. It's just there's going off on a tangent. Yeah, that's a great song. I like House for Sale because that, again, is very got a lot of sadness in it. And from his more recent songs, I love Blue on Blue. I think that's really, really good. So that's sort of my top 10 today. And five of them will always be in there, but the other five might rotate with some other songs, you know.
So, yeah, and you span his whole career there. So he's a great, great – and it's funny because, like, we just take him almost for granted. Like, he's always been around. He's making great music. And you know, then the Christmas album comes out. You talk about that in your book. And then, you know, he hooks up with Los Straitjackets, and he just keeps going, and he just keeps getting better.
Yeah, he's good, and I hope he carries on for many more years. And I think he's enjoying it now more than he did even 10 years ago. And I mean, I go see him do gigs solo, let's say acoustic. He appears to really love it. You know, he's on that on stage, and he's putting it over really, really well. Yeah,
great. So Will Burch's Cruel to Be Kind, The Life and Music of Nick Lowe, is out in paperback from Constable Books. It is a terrific, terrific read. I've actually read it twice, cover to cover. Will, thank you so much for your conversation and the insights into Nick Lowe.
It's been great, Dan. Thank you very much.